Hello, this is your Polycast for Tuesday, September 20th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, a key step in sentencing men who plotted to join ISIS, and Rick Nolan and Stuart Mills debate the issues. Authorities continue to investigate the stabbings at a St. Cloud mall over the weekend as a potential act of terrorism. That finding would realize long-held fears of an attack in this state that has struggled to stop the recruiting of its young men by groups such as the so-called Islamic State. Six young Minnesota men who admitted to plotting to join ISIS will be in a federal courtroom in Minneapolis this week. Daniel Kohler, a German specialist in what's called de-radicalization, will present his evaluations of the young men to a federal judge in Minneapolis. His findings will help the judge decide sentences that could range from probation to lengthy prison time. Friends and family of the defendants are hoping for leniency, but that might be unpopular in the current climate. Laura Ewan has more on the story.
In these tight-knit circles of young Somali-American men, nothing can turn out a crowd like a basketball tournament. But these boys running up and down the court and their friends and families in the stands have also come to this Minneapolis gym for something much more personal.
If everybody can have a seat real quick.
The tournament is designed to be a fundraiser and a show of support for the nine men who've been found guilty or who have pled guilty to trying to enlist with ISIS. To some of the basketball players here, the defendants were once role models and big brother types. Everyone gathers in front of a projector screen to watch an emotional video. It stitches together audio recordings from the men in jail, including Guled Omar. He's one of three young men who were convicted in June.
I want to also let you all know that y'all got to take advantage of your time and your life to also be educated and to also make smart decisions. Always think before you act and always know with every action you take, there's a consequence behind it.
He tells the audience to make sure to hug and kiss their moms and siblings. And a gym of once rambunctious boys is silent. A few wipe away tears. Family members are hoping for leniency when U.S. District Judge Michael Davis sentences the nine ISIS defendants in November. One who pled guilty is 21-year-old Zakria Abdurrahman. His sister, Ikran, says there's more to her eldest brother than what's been in the public eye.
I want Judge Davis to know that Zakria is not just a felon, that he's my brother, he's my support system, he's someone I've always looked up to, and there's this void in our house and in my heart that only Zakria can fill.
She says she wishes any prison sentence will be short and that her brother will be able to rejoin the community soon.
I wish he was here sitting with me. I wish that we can go back to going to school together, that we can travel the world together. I wish that we can all just be a part of one family again, that we can, you know, go horseback riding like we did, go camping like we did. Just kind of go sledding like we did. All these day-to-day, you know, seasonal kind of activities that you don't really think are huge parts of your life until they're gone.
The judge does have a lot of discretion in sentencing, but he must consider a number of factors. That includes federal guidelines and whether the defendants provided substantial assistance to the government by cooperating with the investigation. The maximum the defendants face is 15 years in prison. A review of similar ISIS-related cases around the country by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minneapolis found more than half of the 17 defendants were sentenced to the maximum penalty of 15 years. Judge Davis brought the German de-radicalization expert Daniel Kohler to Minnesota to assess the defendants' chances of rehabilitation. Kohler visited the men last spring and has made his recommendations, which include mentoring and counseling for at least some of the defendants, according to briefs filed by their attorneys. But Kohler's recommendations have not been made public. The hearings, which will be held in the open today and tomorrow, are unprecedented for a terrorism case in the United States. Former Assistant U.S. Attorney Anders Folk says he expects Kohler will receive tough questions from both defense attorneys and prosecutors.
And I think the parties are going to really work to understand whether or not they believe his findings are kind of credible.
Folk added that the judge faces a difficult challenge when determining how much weight to give the expert's findings.
Judge Davis has heard more more evidence live than this expert has, and so he will undoubtedly have reached some of his own conclusions. You know, he's going to have to weigh what he has seen and heard against what this expert finds, which may or may not be consistent with kind of what came out at trial.
Kohler's work in Germany has primarily focused on neo-Nazis, but he has increasingly turned his attention to jihadist de-radicalization. With reporting from Thua Le Saikautau, I'm Laura Yuen, Minnesota Public Radio News.
DFL Congressman Rick Nolan and Republican businessman Stuart Mills squared off in their first and only scheduled debate in Duluth yesterday. It's a rematch of the 2014 race in northeastern Minnesota's 8th congressional district. Nolan won that race by less than 2 percentage points, and as Dan Crocker reports, this time it could be even closer.
The debate was civil, but it did get testy at times. The first question about jobs quickly became a referendum on Nolan's work on behalf of mine workers in northeast Minnesota. The Iron Range has been hit hard by layoffs and mine closures over the past 2 years, but Nolan defended his record.
I went to the International Trade Commission and testified more than any other member of Congress once this crisis started. I didn't see you there. I brought the president's chief of staff out here to hear firsthand how devastating this was on our communities. I didn't see you there.
Mills responded.
You kept saying, you didn't see me there, you didn't see me there. I wasn't the elected representative. That's an unfair attack.
Well, you know what? It's not an unfair attack, because I tell you what, most of the people testifying there were not politicians.
The United Steelworkers have endorsed Nolan. The union credits him with fighting to impose tariffs on illegally traded foreign steel. That has helped some mines on the range reopen, but others remain closed. Mills cited Magnetation, a company that has declared bankruptcy and closed several plants. Elsewhere, Nolan said he's been assured U.S. Steel's Keewatin Taconite plans to reopen.
Everything is not perfect, but it's all heading in the right direction.
But people are still getting pink slips.
Pardon?
But people are still getting their pink slips. People are still unemployed.
Mills said the people he talks to with jobs are nervous, and those who are unemployed are angry. Like Donald Trump, who has stirred up populist anger during his campaign, Mills hopes disaffected workers will back him next month. 2 years ago, he lost by just 3,700 votes. Outside groups poured nearly $13 million into the district during that cycle, the second most in the country. Nolan referred back to the last campaign in response to a question on Social Security and Medicare. He said Mills said during a debate 2 years ago that all options were on the table to deal with the entitlement programs and suggested that Mills supported privatizing them.
Congressman Nolan, with all due respect, that's a lie. What I said was that both houses of Congress, both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, have to come together and put all their ideas on the table. But the first condition that I laid out last time on this debate is that it be bipartisan.
And Mills said since Democrats don't support privatizing Social Security, to say he supports it is intellectually inconsistent.
As long as it's bipartisan.
And I don't care if it's bipartisan, nonpartisan, some weird partisanship. I am not about to privatize Social Security and Medicare. I don't care where it comes
Please.
From.
And you know what I'm for? I'm for open and honest dialogue that's going to fix the problem.
Mills said Medicare could be insolvent as soon as 2023, and Social Security could be on the ropes a decade later. Other domestic issues, including gun policy and health care, dominated the debate. Despite the stabbings in a St. Cloud mall on Saturday, there was little discussion of terrorism, even though the FBI is investigating the incident as a potential act of terrorism. The two did sharply disagree over the Iran nuclear agreement brokered by the Obama administration. Nolan defended his support for the deal, which he called a victory for diplomacy. Mills said the agreement put Iran on a glide path to a nuclear weapon.
This deal has done nothing other than embolden them and make us weaker.
Well, at the end of the day, it's all about stopping the spread of nuclear weapons.
There was barely any discussion of the two presidential candidates. A rarity in this election cycle, Donald Trump's name wasn't mentioned, and Mills only linked Nolan to Hillary Clinton once during his opening statement. About the only thing the two agreed on was to work on behalf of the middle class. Whichever candidate can best persuade those key voters he is on their side is most likely to squeak out a victory in this increasingly competitive district. Covering politics, I'm Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Over the past 6 years, Governor Mark Dayton quietly paid nearly $80,000 in severance to three political appointees who voluntarily resigned their positions. The rarely used practice is a departure from Dayton's predecessor, and it's raising questions from some lawmakers. Tom Scheck with our investigative unit APM Reports has more.
In April, Katie Clark Seabed announced she was resigning her position as commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. At the time, Governor Dayton praised Seabed for her role in promoting Minnesota businesses.
And thank her for her service. She's got tremendous talent, and she'll be a contributing leader of this community for many years to come.
Seabed got more than just praise from Dayton. He gave her a $33,000 severance payout on top of a $10,000 payment for unused vacation and sick time. The governor also authorized a similar payout to Seabed's predecessor, Mark Phillips, in 2012. Phillips got $27,000. A year earlier, the director of the Office of Higher Education, Sheila Wright, got $18,000 in severance pay when she resigned. To put the severance packages in perspective, Seabed's one-time payout is as much as what some employees in her agency make in a year.
We believe that this is consistent with running a state government. It's entirely way below the practice in the private sector.
Myron Franz is commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. He says state law allows his boss to authorize severance payouts for highly paid government workers. Over the past 6 years, Fran says about 1,000 state employees were eligible for severance, but Dayton authorized it only 3 times.
The payouts were made pursuant to the statute because the governor believes it was the appropriate thing to do, and he did so.
I don't think they should get paid a severance, and I think that most Minnesotans believe that that would be excessive.
House Speaker Kurt Dowd and other Republicans say the legislature never authorized the use of severance pay for political appointees. He questions whether severance is justified at all, but particularly if commissioners resign.
The governor has said that these commissioners left voluntarily. If they left voluntarily, there's not a need for a severance.
It isn't clear why Phillips, Seabed, and Wright received a severance, but others didn't get similar payouts when they left state government. Franz couldn't say whether Dayton asked those 3 commissioners to resign. Through a spokesman, Dayton declined an interview request, but issued a statement saying the circumstances justified the severance. Seabed also declined an interview request, but issued a written statement saying she resigned after speaking with the governor and his chief of staff. Mark Phillips says he and Dayton mutually agreed that he should resign. He defended his payout, especially since he didn't have another job lined up.
I left a really good job to be appointed to deed commissioner, so it seemed actually fairly reasonable, if not modest, for me to re-enter the workforce to have 90 days to do that.
Public records show Dayton's predecessor, Republican Tim Pawlenty, didn't authorize such payouts for his political appointees. Dayton has been critical of severance pay for political appointees in the past. As state auditor in the 1990s, he lobbied to cap severance pay for public employees. Here's Dayton criticizing the practice at a legislative hearing in 1993.
The overwhelming majority of citizens who can't be here tonight, whose tax dollars go to pay these salaries and whose trust in government is seriously eroded when they see these kinds of benefits that they can't even dream about, compels this kind of measure.
Dayton and legislators from both parties have sparred over commissioner pay over the years. In 2015, lawmakers objected to Dayton's decision to raise the pay of his cabinet. The legislature eventually granted him the one-time authority to raise their pay. As for Phillips, he found a job in the private sector after he left his post as deed commissioner in 2012. But he rejoined the administration in 2015 when Dayton appointed him to serve as commissioner of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. For APM Reports, I'm Tom Scheck.
And that's your Polycast for this Tuesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.